This is disc number 4.
The nice thing about the constant threat of expulsion at Culver Creek is that it lends excitement to every moment of illicit pleasure. The bad thing, of course, is that there is always the possibility of actual expulsion. 2 days before. I woke up early the next morning, my lips dry and my breath visible in the crisp air. Takumi had brought a camp stove in his backpack, and the colonel was huddled over it, heating instant coffee. The sun shone bright but could not combat the cold, and I sat with the colonel and sipped the coffee. The thing about instant coffee is that it smells pretty good, but it tastes like stomach bile, the colonel said. And then one by one, Takumi, Lara, and Alaska woke up, and we spent the day hiding out, but loudly. Hiding out loud. At the barn that afternoon, Takumi decided we needed to have a freestyle contest.
You start, Pudge, Takumi said. Colonel Catastrophe, you're our beatbox.
Dude, I can't rap, I pled.
That's okay, the colonel can't drop beats either. Just try, and rhyme a little, and then send it over to me.
With his hand cupped over his mouth, the colonel started to make absurd noises that sounded more like farting than bass beats, and I, rapped.
We're sitting in the barn and the sun's going down. When I was a kid at Burger King, I wore a crown. Dude, I can't rhyme for shit, so I'll let my boy Takumi rip it.
Takumi took over without pausing.
Damn, Pudge, I'm not sure I'm quite ready, but like Nightmare on Elm Street's Freddy, I've always got the goods to rip shit up. Last night I drank wine, it was like hiccup. The colonel's beats are sick like malaria. When I rock the mic, the ladies suffer hysteria. I represent Japan as well as Birmingham. When I was a kid, they called me Yellow Man, but I ain't ashamed of my skin color, and neither are the countless bitches that call me lover.
Alaska jumped in.
Oh, shit, did you just diss the feminine gender? I'll pummel your ass, then stick you in a blender. You think I like Tori and Ani, so I can't rhyme, but I got flow like Ghostbusters got slime. Objectify women, and it's fucking on. You'll be dead and gone like ancient Babylon.
Takumi picked it up again.
If my eye offends me, I will pluck it out. I got props for girls like old men got gout. Oh, shit, now my rhyming got all whack. Lara, help me out and pick up the slack.
Lara rhymed quietly and nervously, and with even more flagrant disregard for the beat than me.
My name's Lara, and I'm from Romania. This is pretty hard. I once visited Albania. I love riding in Alaska's geo. My two best vowels in English are eo. I'm not so good with the little eyes, but they make me sound cosmopolitan, right? Oh, Takumi, I think I'm done, and this game with some fun. I drop bombs like Hiroshima, or better yet, Nagasaki. When girls hear me flow, they think that I'm Rocky. To represent my homeland, I still drink sake. The kids don't get my rhyming, so sometimes they mock me. My build ain't small, but I wouldn't call it stocky. Then again, unlike Pudge, I'm not super gawky. I'm the fucking fox, and this is my crew. Our freestyle's infused with funk like my gym shoes, and we're out.
The colonel wrapped it up with freestyle beatboxing, and we gave ourselves a round of applause.
You ripped it up, Alaska, Takumi says, laughing.
I do what I can to represent the ladies. Lara had my back. Yeah, I did.
And then Alaska decided that although it wasn't nearly dark yet, it was time for us to get shit-faced.
Two nights in a row is maybe pushing our luck, Takumi said as Alaska opened the wine.
Luck is for suckers.
She smiled and put the bottle to her lips. We had saltines and a hunk of cheddar cheese provided by the colonel for dinner, and sipping the warm pink wine out of the bottle with our cheese and saltines made for a fine dinner. And when we ran out of cheese, well, all the more room for Strawberry Hill.
We have to slow down, or I'll puke, I remarked after we finished the first bottle.
I'm sorry, Pudge. I wasn't aware that someone was holding open your throat and pouring wine down it, the colonel responded, tossing me a bottle of Mountain Dew.
It's a little charitable to call this shit wine, Takumi cracked.
And then, as if out of nowhere, Alaska announced, Best day, worst day.
Huh?
I asked.
We are all going to puke if we just drink, so we'll slow it down with a drinking game. Best day, worst day.
Never heard of it. The colonel said,
'Cause I just made it up.
She smiled. She lay on her side across two bales of hay, the afternoon light brightening the green in her eyes, her tan skin the last memory of fall. With her mouth half open, it occurred to me that she must already be drunk, as I noticed the far-off look in her eyes. The thousand-yard stare of intoxication, I thought, and as I watched her with an idle fascination, it occurred to me that, yeah, I was a little drunk, too.
Fun. What are the rules? Lara asked.
Everybody tells the story of their best day. The best storyteller doesn't have to drink. Then everybody tells the story of their worst day, and the best storyteller doesn't have to drink. Then we keep going, second best day, second worst day, until one of y'all quits.
How do you know it'll be one of us? Takumi asked.
'Cause I'm the best drinker and the best storyteller, she answered. Hard to disagree with that logic. You start, Pudge. Best day of your life.
Can I take a minute to think of one?
Couldn't have been that good if you have to think about it, the colonel said.
Fuck you, dude.
Touchy.
Best day of my life was today, I said. And the story is that I woke up next to a very pretty Hungarian girl, and it was cold but not too cold, and I had a cup of lukewarm instant coffee and ate Cheerios without milk, and then walked through the woods with Alaska and Takumi. We skipped stones across the creek, which sounds dumb, but it wasn't. I don't know. Like the way the sun is right now, with the long shadows and that kind of bright, soft light you get when the sun isn't quite setting. That's the light that makes everything better, everything prettier. And today, everything just seemed to be in that light. I mean, I didn't do anything, but just sitting here, even if I'm watching the colonel whittle or whatever. Whatever. Great day, today. Best day of my life. You think I'm pretty?
Lara said, and laughed, bashful. I thought
it'd be good to make eye contact with her now, but I couldn't.
And I'm Romanian.
That story ended up being a hell of a lot better than I thought it would be, Alaska said, but I've still got you beat.
Bring it on, baby, I said. A breeze picked up, the tall grass outside the barn tilting away from it, and I pulled my sleeping bag over my shoulders to stay warm.
Best day of my life was January 9th, 1997. I was 8 years old, and my mom and I went to the zoo on a class trip. I liked the bears, she liked the monkeys. Best day ever. End of story.
That's it, the colonel said. That's the best day of your whole life?
Yep.
I liked it, Lara said. I like the monkeys, too.
Lame, said the colonel.
I didn't think it was lame so much as more of Alaska's intentional vagueness, another example of her furthering her own mysteriousness. But still, even though I knew it was intentional, I couldn't help but wonder, what's so fucking great about the zoo? But before I could ask, Lara spoke.
"'Kay, my turn,' said Lara. "'It's easy. The day I came here. I knew English, and my parents didn't. And we came off the airplane, and my relatives were here, aunts and uncles I had not ever seen, in the airport, and my parents were so happy. I was 12, and I had always been the little baby, but that was the first day that my parents needed me and treated me like a grown-up, because they did not know the language, right? They need me to order food and to translate tax and immigration forms and everything else, and that was the day they stopped treating me like a kid. Also, in Romania we were poor, and here we're kinda rich.
She laughed.
All right, Takumi smiled, grabbing the bottle of wine. I lose, because the best day of my life was the day I lost my virginity, and if you think I'm gonna tell you that story, you're gonna have to get me drunker than this.
Not bad, the colonel said. That's not bad. Want to know my best day?
That's the game, Chip, Alaska said, clearly annoyed.
Best day of my life hasn't happened yet, but I know it. I see it every day. The best day of my life is the day I buy my mom a huge fucking house. And not just, like, out in the woods, but in the middle of Mountain Brook, with all the weekday warriors' parents. With all y'all's parents. And I'm not buying it with a mortgage, either. I'm buying it with cash money, and I'm driving my mom there, and I'm going to open her side of the car door, and she'll get out and look at this house. This house is like picket fence and two stories and everything, you know? and I'm going to hand her the keys to her house, and I'll say, thanks. Man, she helped me fill out my application to this place, and she let me come here, and that's no easy thing when you come from where we do, to let your son go away to school. So, that's the best day of my life. Takumi tilted the bottle up and swallowed a few times, then handed it to me. I drank, and so did Lara, and then Alaska put her head back and turned the bottle upside down, quickly downing the last quarter of the bottle. As she unscrewed the next bottle, Alaska smiled at the colonel.
You won that round. Now what's your worst day?
Worst day was when my dad left. He's old, he's like 70 now, and he was old when he married my mom, and he still cheated on her, and she caught him, and she got pissed, so he hit her. And then she kicked him out, and he left. I was here, and my mom called, and she didn't tell me the whole story with the cheating and everything and the hitting until later. She just said that he was gone and not coming back, and I haven't seen him since. All that day, I kept waiting for him to call me and explain it, but he never did. He never called at all. I at least thought he'd say goodbye or something. That was the worst day.
Shit, you got me beat again, I said. My worst day was in 7th grade when Tommy Hewitt pissed on my gym clothes, and then the gym teacher said I had to wear my uniform or I'd fail the class. 7th grade gym, right? There are worse things to fail. But it was a big deal then, and I was crying and trying to explain to the teacher what happened, but it was so embarrassing, and he just yelled and yelled and yelled until I put on these piss-soaked shorts and t-shirt. That was the day I stopped caring what people did. I just never cared anymore about being a loser or not having friends or any of that. So I guess it was good for me in a way, but that moment was awful. I mean, imagine me playing volleyball or whatever in pea-soaked gym clothes while Tommy Hewitt tells everyone what he did. That was the worst day. Lara was laughing. I'm sorry, Miles. All good, I said. Just tell me yours so I can laugh at your pain. And I smiled, and we laughed together.
My worst day was probably the same as my best, because I left everything. I mean, it sounds dumb, but my childhood, too, because most 12-year-olds do not, you know, have to figure out W-2 forms.
What's a W-2 form? I asked.
That's my point. It's for taxes. So, same day.
Lara had always needed to talk for her parents, I thought, and so maybe she never learned how to talk for herself. And I wasn't great at talking for myself, either. We had something important in common, then, a personality quirk I didn't share with Alaska or anybody else, although, almost by definition, Lara and I couldn't express it to each other. So maybe it was just the way the not-yet-setting sun shone against her lazy, dark curls, but at that moment, I wanted to kiss her. And we did not need to talk in order to kiss, and the puking on her jeans and the months of mutual avoidance melted away.
It's your turn, Takumi.
Worst day in my life, Takumi said, June 9, 2000. My grandmother died in Japan. She died in a car accident, and I was supposed to leave to go see her 2 days later. I was going to spend the whole summer with her and my grandfather, but instead, I flew over for her funeral. And the only time I really saw what she looked like, I mean, other than in pictures, was at her funeral. She had a Buddhist funeral, and they cremated her. But before they did, she was on this, like, well, it's not really Buddhist. I mean, religion is complicated there, so it's a little Buddhist and a little Shinto, but y'all don't care. Point being that she was on this, like, funeral pyre or whatever. And that's the only time I ever saw her, was just before they burned her up. That was the worst day.
The colonel lit a cigarette, threw it to me, and lit one of his own. It was eerie that he could tell when I wanted a cigarette. We were like an old married couple. For a moment I thought, it's massively unwise to throw lit cigarettes around a barn full of hay. But then the moment of caution passed, and I just made a sincere effort not to flick ash onto any hay.
No clear winner yet, the colonel said. The field is wide open. Your turn, buddy.
Alaska lay on her back, her hands locked behind her head. She spoke softly and quickly, but the quiet day was becoming a quieter night. The bugs gone now with the arrival of winter, and we could hear her clearly.
The day after my mom took me to the zoo where she liked the monkeys and I liked the bears, it was a Friday. I came home from school. She gave me a hug and told me to go do my homework in my room so I could watch TV later. I went into my room, and she sat down at the kitchen table, I guess, and then she screamed, and I ran out, and she had fallen over. She was lying on the floor, holding her head and jerking, and I freaked out. I should have called 911, but I just started screaming and crying until finally she stopped jerking, and I thought she had fallen asleep, and that whatever had hurt didn't hurt anymore. So I just sat there on the floor with her until my dad got home an hour later, and he's screaming, "Why didn't you call 911?" and trying to give her CPR, but by then she was plenty dead. Aneurysm. Worst day. I win, you drink. And so we did. No one talked for a minute, and then Takumi asked, "Your dad blamed you?" "Well, not after that first moment, but yeah, how could he not?" "Well, you were a little kid," Takumi argued. I was too surprised and uncomfortable to talk, trying to fit this into what I knew about Alaska's family. Her mom told her the knock-knock joke when Alaska was 6. Her mom used to smoke, but didn't anymore, obviously. "Yeah, I was a little kid. Little kids can dial 911. They do it all the time." "Give me the wine," she said, deadpan and emotionless. She drank without lifting her head from the hay. "I'm sorry," Takumi said.
"Why didn't you ever tell me?" the colonel asked, his voice soft.
"It never came up."
And then we stopped asking questions. What the hell do you say? In the long quiet that followed, as we passed around the wine and slowly became drunker, I found myself thinking about President William McKinley, the 3rd American president to be assassinated. He lived for several days after he was shot, and toward the end, his wife started crying and screaming, "I want to go too, I want to go too." And with his last measure of strength, McKinley turned to her and spoke his last words, "We are all going." It was the central moment of Alaska's life. When she cried and told me that she fucked everything up, I knew what she meant now. And when she said she failed everyone, I knew whom she meant. It was the everything and the everyone of her life. And so I could not help but imagine it. I imagined a scrawny 8-year-old with dirty fingers looking down at her mother, convulsing. So she sat down with her dead or maybe not mother, who I imagine was not breathing by then, but wasn't yet cold either. And in the time between dying and death, a little Alaska sat with her mother in silence. And then through the silence and my drunkenness, I caught a glimpse of her as she might have been. She must have come to feel so powerless, I thought, that the one thing she might have done, pick up the phone and call an ambulance, never even occurred to her. There comes a time when we realize that our parents cannot save themselves or save us, that everyone who wades through time eventually gets dragged out to sea by the undertow, that, in short, we are all going. So she became impulsive, scared by her inaction into perpetual action. When the eagle confronted her with expulsion, maybe she blurted out Mariah's name because it was the first that came to mind, because in that moment she didn't want to get expelled and couldn't think past that moment. She was scared, sure, but more importantly, maybe she'd been scared of being paralyzed by fear again. "We are all going," McKinley said to his wife, "and we sure are. There's your labyrinth of suffering. We are all going. Find your way out of that maze." None of which I said out loud to her. Not then, and not ever. We never said another word about it. Instead, it became just another worst day, albeit the worst of the bunch, and as night fell fast, we continued on, drinking and joking. Later that night, after Alaska stuck her finger down her throat and made herself puke in front of all of us because she was too drunk to walk into the woods, I lay down in my sleeping bag. Lara was lying beside me in her bag, which was almost touching mine. I moved my arm to the edge of my bag and pushed it so it slightly overlapped with hers. I pressed my hand against hers. I could feel it, although there were 2 sleeping bags between us. My plan, which struck me as very slick, was to pull my arm out of my sleeping bag and put it into hers, and then hold her hand. It was a good plan, but when I tried to actually get my arm out of the mummy bag, I flailed around like a fish out of water and nearly dislocated my shoulder. She was laughing, and not with me, at me, but we still didn't speak. Having passed the point of no return, I slid my hand into her sleeping bag anyway, and she stifled a giggle as my fingers traced a line from her elbow to her wrist.
"The tickles," she whispered.
So much for me being sexy.
"Sorry,"
I whispered.
"No, it's a nice tickle,"
she said, and held my hand. She laced her fingers in mine and squeezed, and then she rolled over and kissed me. I am sure that she tasted like stale booze, but I did not notice, and I'm sure I tasted like stale booze and cigarettes, but she didn't notice. We were kissing. I thought, this is good. I thought, I am not bad at this kissing, not bad at all. I thought, I am clearly the greatest kisser in the history of the universe. Suddenly, she laughed and pulled away from me. She wiggled a hand out of her sleeping bag and wiped her face.
"You slobbered on my nose," she said, and laughed.
I laughed, too, trying to give her the impression that my nose-slobbering kissing style was intended to be funny.
"I'm sorry."
To borrow the bass system from Alaska, I hadn't hit more than 5 singles in my entire life, so I tried to chalk it up to inexperience.
"I'm a bit new at this," I said. "It was a nice slobbering," she said,
laughed, and kissed me again. Soon, we were entirely out of our sleeping bags, making out quietly. She lay on top of me, and I held her small waist in my hands. I could feel her breasts against my chest, and she moved slowly on top of me, her legs straddling me.
"You feel nice," she said.
"You're beautiful," I said, and smiled at her. In the dark, I could make out the outline of her face and her large round eyes blinking down at me, her eyelashes almost fluttering against my forehead.
"Could the two people who are making out please be quiet?" the colonel asked loudly from his sleeping bag. "Those of us who are not making out are drunk and tired."
"Mostly drunk,"
Alaska said slowly, as if enunciation required great effort. We had almost never talked, Lara and I, and we didn't get a chance to talk any more because of the colonel. So we kissed quietly and laughed softly with our mouths and our eyes. After so much kissing that it almost started to get boring, I whispered,
"Do you want to be my girlfriend?"
And she said,
"Yes, please,"
and smiled. We slept together in her sleeping bag, which felt a little crowded, to be honest, but was still nice. I had never felt another person against me as I slept. It was a fine end to the best day of my life. One day before. The next morning, a term I use loosely since it was not yet dawn, the colonel shook me awake. Lara was wrapped in my arms, folded into my body.
"We gotta go, Pudge. Time to roll up."
"Dude, sleeping."
"You can sleep after we check in."
"It's time to go," he shouted. All right, no screaming. Head hurts."
And it did. I could feel last night's wine in my throat, and my head throbbed like it had the morning after my concussion. My mouth tasted like a skunk had crawled into my throat and died. I made an effort not to exhale near Lara as she groggily extricated herself from the sleeping bag. We packed everything quickly, threw our empty bottles into the tall grass of the field. Littering was an unfortunate necessity at the creek, since no one wanted to throw an empty bottle of booze in a campus trash can, and walked away from the barn. Lara grabbed my hand and then shyly let go. Alaska looked like a train wreck, but insisted on pouring the last few sips of Strawberry Hill into her cold instant coffee before chucking the bottle behind her.
"Hair of the dog," she said.
"How you doing?" the colonel asked her.
"I've had better mornings."
"Hungover?"
"Like an alcoholic preacher on Sunday morning."
"Maybe you shouldn't drink so much," I suggested.
"Pudge."
She shook her head and sipped the cold coffee and wine.
"Pudge, what you must understand about me is that I am a deeply unhappy person."
We walked side by side down the washed-out dirt road on our way back to campus. Just after we reached the bridge, Takumi stopped, said, "Uh-oh," got on his hands and knees, and puked a volcano of yellow and pink.
"Let it out," Alaska said. "You'll be fine."
He finished, stood up, and said,
"I finally found something that can stop the fox. The fox cannot summit Strawberry Hill."
Alaska and Lara walked to their rooms, planning to check in with the Eagle later in the day, while Takumi and I stood behind the colonel as he knocked on the Eagle's door at 9 a.m.
"Y'all are home early. Have fun."
"Yes, sir," the colonel said.
"How's your mom, Chip?"
"She's doing well, sir. She's in good shape."
"She feeds y'all well?"
"Oh, yes, sir," I said. "She tried to fatten me up."
"You need it. Y'all have a good day."
"Well, I don't think he suspected anything," the colonel said on our way back to room 43. "So maybe we actually pulled it off."
I thought about going over to see Lara, but I was pretty tired, so I just went to bed and slept through my hangover. It was not an eventful day. I should have done extraordinary things. I should have sucked the marrow out of life. But on that day, I slept 18 hours out of a possible 24.
The next morning, the first Monday of the new semester, the colonel came out of the shower just as my alarm went off. As I pulled on my shoes, Kevin knocked once and then opened the door, stepping inside.
"You're looking good," the colonel said casually.
Kevin now sported a crew cut, a small patch of short blue hair on each side of his head just above the ear. His lower lip jutted out, the morning's first dip. He walked over to our coffee table, picked up a can of Coke, and spit into it.
"You almost didn't get me. I noticed it in my conditioner and got right back in the shower, but I didn't notice it in my gel. It didn't show up in Jeff's hair at all, but Longwell and me, we had to go with the marine look. Thank God I have clippers."
"It suits you," I said, although it didn't. The short hair accentuated his features, specifically his too-close-together beady eyes, which did not stand up well to accentuation. The colonel was trying hard to look tough, ready for whatever Kevin might do, but it's hard to look tough when you're only wearing an orange towel.
"Truce." "Well, your troubles aren't over, I'm afraid," the colonel said, referring to the mailed but not yet received progress reports.
"All right, if you say so. We'll talk when it's over, I guess."
"I guess so," the colonel said.
As Kevin walked out, the colonel said,
"Take the can you spit in, you unhygienic shit."
Kevin just closed the door behind him. The colonel grabbed the can, opened the door, and threw it at Kevin, missing him by a good margin.
"Jeez, go easy on the guy."
"No truce yet, Pudge."
I spent that afternoon with Lara. We were very cutesy, even though we didn't know the first thing about each other and barely talked. But we made out. She grabbed my butt at one point, and I sort of jumped. I was lying down, but I did the best version of jumping that one can do lying down. And she said,
"Sorry."
And I said, "No, it's okay. It's just a little sore from the swan." We walked to the TV room together, and I locked the door. We were watching The Brady Bunch, which she had never seen. The episode where the Bradys visit the gold mining ghost town and they all get locked up in a one-room jail by some crazy old gold panner with a scraggly white beard, was especially horrible and gave us a lot to laugh about, which is good since we didn't have much to talk about. Just as the Bradys were getting locked in jail, Lara randomly asked me,
"Have you ever gotten a blowjob?"
That's out of the blue," I said.
"The blue?
Like, you know, out of left field."
"Left field?
Like in baseball, like out of nowhere. I mean, what made you think of that?"
"I've just never given one," she answered, her little voice dripping with seductiveness. "It was so brazen. I thought I would explode. I never thought. I mean, from Alaska, hearing that stuff was one thing. But to hear her sweet little Romanian voice go so sexy all of a sudden."
"No," I said, "I never have."
"Think it would be fun?"
"Do I?" I thought.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to."
"I think I want to," she said, and we kissed a little. And then,
with me sitting watching the Brady Bunch, watching Marsha, Marsha, Marsha up to her Brady antics, Laura unbuttoned my pants and pulled my boxers down a little and pulled out my penis.
"Wow," she said.
"What?" She looked up at me but didn't move, her face nanometers away from my penis.
"It's weird."
"What do you mean, weird?"
"Just big, I guess."
I could live with that kind of weird. And then she wrapped her hand around it
and put it into her mouth, and waited. We were both very still. She did not move a muscle in her body, and I did not move a muscle in mine. I knew at this point something else was supposed to happen, but I wasn't quite sure what. She stayed still. I could feel her nervous breath. For minutes, for as long as it took the Bradys to steal the key and unlock themselves from the ghost town jail, she lay there, stock still, with my penis in her mouth, and I sat there, waiting. And then she took it out of her mouth and looked up at me quizzically.
"Should I do something?"
I don't know, I said. Everything I'd learned from watching porn with Alaska suddenly exited my brain. I thought maybe she should move her head up and down, but wouldn't that choke her? So I just stayed quiet.
"Should I, like, bite?"
"Don't bite! I mean, I don't think. I mean, that felt good. That was nice. I don't know if there's something else."
"I mean, you didn't..."
Maybe we should ask Alaska. So we went to her room and asked Alaska. She laughed and laughed. Sitting on her bed, she laughed until she cried. She walked into the bathroom, returned with a tube of toothpaste, and showed us. In detail. Never have I so wanted to be crest complete. Laura and I went back to her room, where she did exactly what Alaska told her to do, and I did exactly what Alaska said I would do, which was die 100 little ecstatic deaths, my fists clenched, my body shaking. It was my first orgasm with a girl, and afterward I was embarrassed and nervous, and so clearly was Laura, who finally broke the silence by asking,
"So, do you want to do some homework?"
There was little to do on the first day of the semester, but she read for her English class. I picked up a biography of Argentinian revolutionary Che Guevara, whose face adorned a poster on the wall that Laura's roommate had on her bookshelf. Then I lay down next to Laura on the bottom bunk. I began at the end, as I sometimes did with biographies I had no intention of reading all the way through, and found his last words without too much searching. Captured by the Bolivian army, Guevara said, "Shoot, coward. You are only going to kill a man." I thought back to Simón Bolívar's last words in García Márquez's novel, "How Will I Ever Get Out of This Labyrinth?" South American revolutionaries, it would seem, died with flair. I read the last words out loud to Lara. She turned on her side, placing her head on my chest.
"Why do you like last words so much?"
Strange as it might seem, I'd never really thought about why. "I don't know," I said, placing my hand against the small of her back. "Sometimes just because they're funny. Like, in the Civil War, a general named Sedgwick said, 'They couldn't hit an elephant from this dis—' and then he got shot." She laughed. "But a lot of times, people die how they live, and so last words tell me a lot about who people were and why they became the sort of people biographies get written about. Does that make sense?"
"Yeah,"
she said. "Yeah? Just yeah?"
"Yeah,"
she said, and then went back to reading. I didn't know how to talk to her, and I was frustrated with trying, so after a little while, I got up to go. I kissed her goodbye. I could do that, at least. I picked up Alaska and the colonel at our room, and we walked down to the bridge, where I repeated in embarrassing detail the fellatio fiasco. "I can't believe she went down on you twice in one day," the colonel said.
"Only technically, really just once,"
Alaska corrected.
Still, Pudge got his hog smoked."
"The poor colonel," Alaska said with a rueful smile. "I'd give you a pity blow, but I really am attached to Jake."
"That's just creepy," the colonel said. "You're only supposed to flirt with Pudge."
"But Pudge has a girlfriend,"
she laughed. That night, the colonel and I walked down to Alaska's room to celebrate our barn night success. She and the colonel had been celebrating a lot the past couple days, and I didn't feel up to climbing Strawberry Hill, so I sat and munched on pretzels while Alaska and the colonel drank wine from paper cups with flowers on them.
"We ain't drinking out the bottle tonight, hon," the colonel said. "We classin' it up."
"It's an old-time southern drinking contest," Alaska responded. "We's a-gonna treat Pudge to an evening of real southern livin'. We gon' match each other Dixie cup for Dixie cup till the lesser drinker falls."
And that is pretty much what they did, pausing only to turn out the lights at 11 so the eagle wouldn't drop by. They chatted some, but mostly they drank, and I drifted out of the conversation and ended up squinting through the dark, looking at the book spines in Alaska's Life Library. Even minus the books she'd lost in the mini-flood, I could have stayed up until morning reading through haphazard stacks of titles. A dozen white tulips in a plastic vase were precariously perched atop one of the book stacks, and when I asked her about them, she just said, "Jake and Mai's anniversary." And I didn't care to continue that line of dialogue, so I went back to scanning titles. And I was just wondering how I could go about learning Edgar Allan Poe's last words, for the record, "Lord help my poor soul," when I heard Alaska say, "Pudge isn't even listening to us." And I said, "I'm listening. We were just talking about truth or dare. Played out in seventh grade or still cool?" "Never played it," I said. "No friends in seventh grade."
"Well, that does it,"
she shouted, a bit too loud given the late hour, and also given the fact that she was openly drinking wine in the room.
"Truth or dare?"
"All right," I agreed, "but I'm not making out with the colonel." The colonel sat slumped in the corner.
"Can't make out. Too drunk."
Alaska started.
"Truth or dare, Pudge?"
"Dare."
"Hook up with me."
So I did. It was that quick. I laughed, looked nervous, and she leaned in and tilted her head to the side, and we were kissing. Zero layers between us. Our tongues dancing back and forth in each other's mouth until there was no her mouth and my mouth, but only our mouths intertwined. She tasted like cigarettes and Mountain Dew and wine and chapstick. Her hand came to my face, and I felt her soft fingers tracing the line of my jaw. We lay down as we kissed, she on top of me, and I began to move beneath her. I pulled away for a moment to say, "What is going on here?" And she put one finger to her lips, and we kissed again. A hand grabbed one of mine, and she placed it on her stomach. I moved slowly on top of her and felt her arching her back fluidly beneath me. I pulled away again.
"What about Lara? Jake?"
Again, she shushed me.
"Less tongue, more lips," she said,
and I tried my best. I thought the tongue was the whole point, but she was the expert.
"Christ," the colonel said quite loudly. "That wretched beast drama draws nigh."
But we paid no attention. She moved my hand from her waist to her breast, and I felt cautiously, my fingers moving slowly under her shirt but over her bra, tracing the outline of her breasts and then cupping one in my hand, squeezing softly.
"You're good at that," she whispered.
Her lips never left mine as she spoke. We moved together, my body between her legs.
"This is so fun," she whispered, "but I'm so sleepy. To be continued?"
She kissed me for another moment, my mouth straining to stay near hers, and then she moved from beneath me, placed her head on my chest, and fell asleep instantly. We didn't have sex. We never got naked. I never touched her bare breast, and her hands never got lower than my hips. It didn't matter. As she slept, I whispered, "I love you, Alaska Young." Just as I was falling asleep, the colonel spoke.
"Dude, did you just make out with Alaska?"
"Yeah."
"This is going to end poorly," he said to himself.
And then I was asleep. That deep, can still taste her in my mouth sleep. That sleep that's not particularly restful, but is difficult to wake from all the same. And then I heard the phone ring. I think. And I think, although I can't know, that I felt Alaska get up. I think I heard her leave. I think. How long she was gone is impossible to know. But the colonel and I both woke up when she returned, whenever that was, because she slammed the door. She was sobbing, like that post-Thanksgiving morning, but worse.
"I have to get out of here," she cried.
"What's wrong?" I asked.
"I forgot. God, how many times can I fuck up?" she said.
I didn't even have time to wonder what she forgot before she screamed,
"I just have to go. Help me get out of here."
Where do you need to go? She sat down and put her head between her legs, sobbing.
Just please distract the eagle right now so I can go, please.
The colonel and I, at the same moment equal in our guilt, said, okay.
Just don't turn on your lights, the colonel said. Just drive slow and don't turn on your lights. Are you sure you're okay?
Fuck, she said. Just get rid of the eagle for me, she said, her sobs childlike half-screams. God, oh God, I'm so sorry.
Okay, colonel said. Start the car when you hear the second string.
We left. We did not say, don't drive, you're drunk. We did not say, we aren't letting you in that car when you are upset. We did not say, we insist on going with you. We did not say, this can wait until tomorrow. Anything, everything can wait. We walked to our bathroom, grabbed the three strings of leftover firecrackers from beneath the sink, and ran to the Eagles. We weren't sure that it would work again. But it worked well enough. The eagle tore out of his house as soon as the first string of firecrackers started popping. He was waiting for us, I suppose, and we headed for the woods and got him in deeply enough that he never heard her drive away. The colonel and I doubled back, wading through the creek to save time, slipped in through the back window of room 43, and slept like babies. After. The day after. The colonel slept the not-restful sleep of the drunk, and I lay on my back on the bottom bunk, my mouth tingling and alive, as if still kissing, and we would have likely slept through our morning classes had the eagle not awoken us at 8 o'clock with three quick knocks. I rolled over as he opened the door, and the morning light rushed into the room.
"I need y'all to go to the gym," he said.
I squinted toward him, the eagle himself backlit into invisibility by the too bright sun.
Now, he added, and I knew it, we were done for, caught.
Too many progress reports, too much drinking in too short a time. Why did they have to drink last night? And then I could taste her again, the wine and the cigarette smoke and the chapstick and Alaska. And I wondered if she had kissed me because she was drunk.
Don't expel me, I thought. Don't. I have just begun to kiss her.
And as if answering my prayers, the eagle said,
you're not in any trouble, but you need to go to the gym now.
I heard the colonel rolling over above me.
What's wrong?
Something terrible has happened, the eagle said, and then closed the door.
As he grabbed a pair of jeans lying on the floor, the colonel said,
this happened a couple years ago, when Hyde's wife died. I guess it's the old man himself now. Poor bastard really didn't have many breaths left.
He looked up at me, his half-open eyes bloodshot, and yawned.
You look a little hungover, I observed.
He closed his eyes.
Well, then I'm putting up a good front, Pudge, 'cause I'm actually a lot hungover.
I kissed Alaska.
Yeah, I wasn't that drunk. Let's go.
We walked across the dorm circle to the gym. I sported baggy jeans, a sweatshirt with no shirt underneath, and a bad case of bedhead. All the teachers were in the dorm circle, knocking on doors, but I didn't see Dr. Hyde. I imagined him lying dead in his house, wondering who had found him, how they even knew he was missing before he failed to show up for class.
I don't see Dr. Hyde, I told the colonel.
Poor bastard.
The gym was half full by the time we arrived. A podium had been set up in the middle of the basketball court, close to the bleachers. I sat in the second row with the colonel directly in front of me. My thoughts were split between sadness for Dr. Hyde and excitement about Alaska, remembering the up-close sight of her mouth whispering,
to be continued?
And it did not occur to me, not even when Dr. Hyde shuffled into the gym, taking tiny, slow steps toward the colonel and me. I tapped the colonel on the shoulder and said, Hyde's here. And the colonel said,
oh, shit.
And I said, what? And he said,
where's Alaska?
And I said, no. And he said,
Pudge, is she here or not?
and then we both stood up and scanned the faces in the gym. The eagle walked to the podium and said, "Is everyone here?" "No," I said to him, "Alaska isn't here." The eagle looked down. "Is everyone else here?" "Alaska isn't here." "Okay, Miles, thank you." "We can't start without Alaska." The eagle looked at me. He was crying, noiselessly. Tears just rolled from his eyes to his chin and then fell onto his corduroy pants. He stared at me, but it was not the look of doom. His eyes blinking the tears down his face, the eagle looked for all the world sorry. "Please, sir," I said, "can we please wait for Alaska?" I felt all of them staring at us, trying to understand what I now knew but didn't quite believe. The eagle looked down and bit his lower lip. "Last night, Alaska Young was in a terrible accident." His tears came faster then. "And she was killed. Alaska has passed away." For a moment, everyone in the gym was silent, and the place had never been so quiet, not even in the moments before the colonel ridiculed opponents at the free throw stripe. I stared down at the back of the colonel's head. I just stared, looking at his thick and bushy hair. For a moment, it was so quiet that you could hear the sound of not breathing, the vacuum created by 190 students shocked out of air. I thought, it's all my fault. I thought, I don't feel very good. I thought, I'm going to throw up. I stood up and ran outside. I made it to a trash can outside the gym, 5 feet from the double doors, and heaved toward Gatorade bottles and half-eaten McDonald's. But nothing much came out. I just heaved, my stomach muscles tightening and my throat opening and a gasping guttural blech going through the motions of vomiting over and over again. In between gags and coughs, I sucked air in hard. Her mouth. Her dead, cold mouth. To not be continued. I knew she was drunk, upset. Obviously, you don't let someone drive drunk and pissed off. Obviously. And Christ, Miles, what the hell is wrong with you? And then comes the puke, finally splashing onto the trash. And here is whatever of her I had left in my mouth, here in this trash can. And then it comes again, more. And then, okay, calm down. Okay, seriously, she's not dead. She's not dead. She's alive. She's alive somewhere. She's in the woods. Alaska is hiding in the woods, and she's not dead. She's just hiding. She's playing a trick on us. This is just an Alaska Young prank extraordinaire. It's Alaska being Alaska, funny and playful and not knowing when or how to put on the brakes. And then I felt much better, because she had not died at all. I walked back into the gym, and everyone seemed to be in various stages of disintegration. It was like something you see on TV, like a National Geographic special on funeral rituals. I saw Takumi standing over Lara, his hands on her shoulders. I saw Kevin with his crew cut, his head buried between his knees. A girl named Molly Tan, who'd studied with us for pre-calc, wailed, beating bald fists against her thighs. All these people I sort of knew and sort of didn't, and all of them disintegrating. And then I saw the colonel, his knees tucked into his chest, lying on his side on the bleachers, Madame O'Malley sitting next to him, reaching toward his shoulder but not actually touching it. The colonel was screaming. He would inhale and then scream. Inhale, scream. Inhale, scream. I thought at first that it was only yelling, but after a few breaths, I noticed a rhythm, and after a few more, I realized that the colonel was saying words. He was screaming, "I'm so sorry." Madame O'Malley grabbed his hand. "You've got nothing to be sorry for, Chip. There was nothing you could have done." But if only she knew. And I just stood there, looking at the scene, thinking about her not dead, and I felt a hand on my shoulder and turned around to see the eagle. And I said, "I think she's playing a dumb prank." And he said, "No, Miles, no. I'm sorry." And I felt the heat in my cheeks and said, "She's really good. She could pull this off." And he said, I saw her. I'm sorry.
What happened?
Somebody was setting off firecrackers in the woods, he said, and I closed my eyes tight, the ineluctable fact of the matter at hand. I had killed her. I went out after them, and I guess she drove off campus. It was late. She was on I-65 just south of downtown. A truck had jackknifed, blocking both lanes. A police car had just gotten to the scene. She hit the cruiser without ever swerving. I believe she must have been very intoxicated. The police said they smelled alcohol.
How do you know? I asked.
I saw her, Miles. I talked to the police. It was instant. The steering wheel hit her chest. I'm so sorry.
And I said, you saw her? And he said, yes. And I said, how did she look? And he said, just a bit of blood coming out of her nose.
And I sat down on the floor of the gym. I could hear the colonel still screaming, and I could feel hands on my back as I hunched forward, but I could only see her lying naked on a metal table, a small trickle of blood falling out of her half-teardrop nose, her green eyes open, staring off into the distance, her mouth turned up just enough to suggest the idea of a smile, and she had felt so warm against me, her mouth soft and warm on mine.
The colonel and I are walking back to our dorm room in silence. I am staring at the ground beneath me. I cannot stop thinking that she is dead, and I cannot stop thinking that she cannot possibly be dead. People do not just die. I can't catch my breath. I feel afraid, like someone has told me they're going to kick my ass after school, and it's now sixth period, and I know full well what's coming. It is so cold today, literally freezing, and I imagine running to the creek and diving in head first. The creek's so shallow that my hands scrape against the rocks, and my body slides into the cold water, the shock of the cold giving way to numbness, and I would stay there, float down with that water, first to the Cahaba River, then to the Alabama River, then to Mobile Bay and the Gulf of Mexico. I want to melt into the brown, crunchy grass that the colonel and I step on as we silently make our way back to our room. His feet are so large, too large for his short body, and the new generic tennis shoes he wears since his old ones were pissed in look almost like clown shoes. I think of Alaska's flip-flops clinging to her blue toes as we swung on the swing down by the lake. Will the casket be open? Can a mortician recreate her smile? I could still hear her saying, "This is so fun, but I'm so sleepy." To be continued. 19th-century preacher Henry Ward Beecher's last words were, "Now comes the mystery." The poet Dylan Thomas, who liked a good drink at least as much as Alaska, said, "I've had 18 straight whiskeys. I do believe that's a record," before dying. Alaska's favorite was playwright Eugene O'Neill. Born in a hotel room and, goddammit, died in a hotel room. Even car accident victims sometimes have time for last words. Princess Diana said, "Oh God, what's happened?" Movie star James Dean said, "They've got to see us," just before slamming his Porsche into another car. I know so many last words, but I will never know hers. I am several steps in front of him before I realize that the colonel has fallen down. I turn around, and he is lying on his face. "We have to get up, Chip. We have to get up. We just have to get to the room." The colonel turns his face from the ground to me and looks me dead in the eye and says, "I can't breathe." But he can breathe, and I know this because he is hyperventilating, breathing as if trying to blow air back into the dead. I pick him up, and he grabs onto me and starts sobbing, again saying, "I'm so sorry," over and over again. We have never hugged before, me and the colonel, and there is nothing much to say, because he ought to be sorry. And I just put my hand on the back of his head and say the only true thing. I'm sorry, too. 2 days after. I didn't sleep that night. Dawn was slow in coming, and even when it did, the sun shining bright through the blinds, the rickety radiator couldn't keep us warm, so the colonel and I sat wordlessly on the couch. He read the almanac.
The night before, I'd braved the cold to call my parents, and this time when I said, "Hey, it's Miles," and my mom answered with, "What's wrong? Is everything okay?" I could safely tell her no, everything was not okay. My dad picked up the line then. "What's wrong?" he asked.
"Don't yell," my mother said. "I'm not yelling, it's just the phone." "Well, talk quieter," she said, and so it took some time before I could say anything. And then once I could, it took some time to say the words in order.
My friend Alaska died in a car crash. I stared at the numbers and messages scrawled on the wall by the phone.
"Oh, Miles," Mom said. "I'm so sorry, Miles. Do you want to come home?"
"No," I said. "I want to be here."
"I can't believe it,"
which was still partly true. "That's just awful," my dad said. "Her poor parents." Poor parent, I thought, and wondered about her dad. I couldn't even imagine what my parents would do if I died. Driving drunk. God, if her father ever found out, he would disembowel the colonel and me.
"What can we do for you right now?" my mom asked.
"I just needed you to pick up. I just needed you to answer the phone, and you did." I heard a sniffle behind me, from cold or grief I don't know, and told my parents, "Someone's waiting for the phone. I gotta go." All night, I felt paralyzed into silence, terrorized. What was I so afraid of, anyway? The thing had happened. She was dead. She was warm and soft against my skin, my tongue in her mouth, and she was laughing, trying to teach me, make me better, promising to be continued. And now? And now she was colder by the hour, more dead with every breath I took. I thought, that is the fear. I have lost something important, and I cannot find it, and I need it. It is fear like if someone lost his glasses and went to the glasses store, and they told him that the world had run out of glasses, and he would just have to do without. Just before 8 in the morning, the colonel announced to no one in particular, "I think there are bufritos at lunch today." "Yeah," I said. "Are you hungry?"
"God, no. But she named them, you know. They were called fried burritos when we got here, and Alaska started calling them bufritos, and then everyone did, and then finally Maureen officially changed the name."
He paused.
"I don't know what to do, Miles."
"Yeah, I know."
"I finished memorizing the capitals," he said.
"Of the states?"
"No, that was fifth grade. Of the countries. Name a country."
"Canada," I said.
"Something hard."
Uzbekistan?
"Tashkent."
He didn't even take a moment to think. It was just there at the tip of his tongue, as if he'd been waiting for me to say Uzbekistan all along. "Let's smoke." We walked to the bathroom and turned on the shower, and the colonel pulled a pack of matches from his jeans and struck a match against the matchbook. It didn't light. Again, he tried and failed, and again, smacking the matchbook with a crescendoing fury until he finally threw the matches to the ground and screamed, "God damn it!" "It's okay," I said, reaching into my pocket for a lighter.
"No, Pudge, it's not,"
he said, throwing down his cigarette and standing up, suddenly pissed. "God damn it! God, how did this happen? How could she be so stupid? She just never thought anything through, so goddamned impulsive. Christ, it is not okay! I can't believe she was so stupid." "We should have stopped her," I said. He reached into the stall to turn off the dribbling shower and then pounded an open palm against the tile wall.
"Yeah, I know we should have stopped her, damn it. I am shit sure keenly aware that we should have stopped her. But we shouldn't have had to. You had to watch her like a 3-year-old. You do one thing wrong, and then she just dies. Christ, I'm losing it. I'm going on a walk."
"Okay," I answered, trying to keep my voice calm.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I feel so screwed up. I feel like I might die."
"You might," I said.
"Yeah. Yeah, I might. You never know. It's just, it's like, poof. and you're gone.
I followed him into the room. He grabbed the almanac from his bunk, zipped his jacket, closed the door, and poof, he was gone. With morning came visitors. An hour after the colonel left, resident stoner Hank Walston dropped by to offer me some weed, which I graciously turned down. Hank hugged me and said,
"At least it was instant. At least there wasn't any pain."
I knew he was only trying to help, but he didn't get it. There was pain. A dull, endless pain in my gut that wouldn't go away even when I knelt on the stingingly frozen tile of the bathroom, dry heaving. And what is an instant death, anyway? How long is an instant? Is it 1 second? 10? The pain of those seconds must have been awful as her heart burst and her lungs collapsed, and there was no air and no blood to her brain and only raw panic. What the hell is instant? Nothing is instant. Instant rice takes 5 minutes. Instant pudding, an hour. I doubt that an instant of blinding pain feels particularly instantaneous. Was there time for her life to flash before her eyes? Was I there? Was Jake? And she promised, I remembered, she promised to be continued. But I knew, too, that she was driving north when she died. North toward Nashville. Toward Jake. Maybe it hadn't meant anything to her. Had been nothing more than another grand impulsivity. And as Hank stood in the doorway, I just looked past him, looking across the too quiet dorm circle, wondering if it had mattered to her. And I can only tell myself that, of course, yes, she had promised to be continued. Lara came next, her eyes heavy with swelling. "What happened?" she asked me as I held her, standing on my tiptoes so I could place my chin on top of her head. "I don't know," I said. "Did you see her that night?" she asked, speaking into my collarbone. "She got drunk," I told her. "The colonel and I went to sleep, and I guess she drove off campus." And that became the standard lie. I felt Lara's fingers, wet with her tears, press against my palm, and before I could think better of it, I pulled my hand away. "I'm sorry," I said. "It's okay," she said. "I'll be in my room if you want to come by." I did not drop by. I didn't know what to say to her. I was caught in a love triangle with one dead side. That afternoon, we all filed into the gym again for a town meeting. The Eagle announced that the school would charter a bus on Sunday to the funeral in Vine Station. As we got up to leave, I noticed Takumi and Lara walking toward me. Lara caught my eye and smiled wanly. I smiled back, but quickly turned and hid myself amid the mass of mourners filing out of the gym. I am sleeping, and Alaska flies into the room. She is naked and intact. Her breasts, which I felt only very briefly and in the dark, are luminously full as they hang down from her body. She hovers inches above me, her breath warm and sweet against my face, like a breeze passing through tall grass. "Hi," I say. "I've missed you."
"You look good, Pudge."
"So do you."
"I'm so naked," she says, and laughs. "How did I get so naked?"
"I just want you to stay," I say.
"No,"
she says, and her weight falls dead on me, crushing my chest, stealing away my breath, and she is cold and wet like melting ice. Her head is split in half, and a pink-gray sludge oozes from the fracture in her skull and drips down onto my face, and she stinks of formaldehyde and rotting meat. I gag and push her off me, terrified. I woke up falling and landed with a thud on the floor. Thank God I'm a bottom bunk man. I had slept for 14 hours. It was morning. Wednesday, I thought. Her funeral Sunday. I wondered if the colonel would get back by then. Where he was. He had to come back for the funeral, because I could not go alone. And going with anyone other than the colonel would amount to alone. The cold wind buffeted against the door, and the trees outside the back window shook with such force that I could hear it from our room. And I sat in my bed and thought of the colonel out there somewhere, his head down, his teeth clenched, walking into the wind. 4 days after. It was 5 in the morning, and I was reading a biography of the explorer Meriwether Lewis of And Clark fame and trying to stay awake when the door opened and the colonel walked in. His pale hands shook, and the almanac he held looked like a puppet dancing without strings. "Are you cold?" I asked. He nodded, slipped off his sneakers, and climbed into my bed on the bottom bunk, pulling up the covers. His teeth chattered like Morse code. "Jesus, are you all right?"
"Better now. Warmer," he said.
A small ghost-white hand appeared from beneath the comforter.
"Hold my hand, will you?"
"All right, but that's it. No kissing." The quilt shook with his laughter. "Where have you been?"
"I walked to Montevallo."
40 miles?
42, he corrected me. "Well, 42 there, 42 back. 82 miles. No, 84. Yes, 84 miles in 45 hours.
"What the hell's in Montevallo?" I asked.
"Not much. I just walked till I got too cold, and then I turned around."
"You didn't sleep?"
"No. The dreams are terrible. In my dreams, she doesn't even look like herself anymore. I don't even remember what she looked like."
I let go of his hand, grabbed last year's yearbook, and found her picture. In the black and white photograph, she's wearing her orange tank top and cut-off jeans that stretch halfway down her skinny thighs, her mouth open wide in a frozen laugh, as her left arm holds Takumi in a headlock. Her hair falls over her face just enough to obscure her cheeks.
"Right," the colonel said. "Yeah, I was so tired of her getting upset for no reason. The way she would get sulky and make references to the freaking oppressive weight of tragedy or whatever, but then never said what was wrong, never have any goddamn reason to be sad. And I just think you ought to have a reason. My girlfriend dumped me, so I'm sad. I got caught smoking, so I'm pissed off. My head hurts, so I'm cranky. She never had a reason, Pudge. I was just so tired of putting up with her drama. And I just let her go. Christ."
Her moodiness had annoyed me too sometimes, but not that night. That night I let her go because she told me to. It was that simple for me, and that stupid. The colonel's hand was so little, and I grabbed it tight, his cold seeping into me and my warmth into him.
"I memorized the populations," he said.
"Uzbekistan."
24,755,519.
"Cameroon," I said, but it was too late. He was asleep, his hand limp in mine. I placed it back under the quilt and climbed up into his bed, a top bunk man for this night at least. I fell asleep listening to his slow, even breaths, his stubbornness finally melting away in the face of insurmountable fatigue. 6 days after. That Sunday, I got up after 3 hours of sleep and showered for the first time in a long while. I put on my only suit. I almost hadn't brought it, but my mom insisted that you never know when you're going to need a suit, and sure enough. The colonel did not own a suit, and by virtue of his stature could not borrow one from anyone at the creek, so he wore black slacks and a gray button-down.
"I don't suppose I can wear the flamingo tie," he said as he pulled on black socks.
"It's a bit festive given the occasion," I responded.
"Can't wear it to the opera," said the colonel, almost smiling. "Can't wear it to a funeral. Can't use it to hang myself. It's a bit useless as ties go."
I gave him a tie. The school had chartered buses to ferry students north to Alaska's hometown of Vine Station, but Lara, the colonel, Takumi, and I drove in Takumi's SUV, taking the back roads so we didn't have to drive past the spot on the highway. I stared out the window, watching as the suburban sprawl surrounding Birmingham faded into the slow-sloping hills and fields of northern Alabama. Up front, Takumi told Lara about the time Alaska got her boob honked over the summer, and Lara laughed. That was the first time I had seen her, and now we were coming to the last. More than anything, I felt the unfairness of it, the inarguable injustice of loving someone who might have loved you back but can't due to deadness. And then I leaned forward, my forehead against the back of Takumi's headrest, and I cried, whimpering. And I didn't even feel sadness so much as pain. It hurt, and that is not a euphemism. It hurt like a beating. Meriwether Lewis's last words were, "I am not a coward, but I am so strong. So hard to die." I don't doubt that it is, but it cannot be much harder than being left behind. I thought of Lewis as I followed Lara into the A-frame chapel attached to the single-story funeral home in Vine Station, Alabama, a town every bit as depressed and depressing as Alaska had always made it out to be. The place smelled of mildew and disinfectant, and the yellow wallpaper in the foyer was peeling at the corners. "Are y'all here for Ms. Young?" a guy asked the colonel, and the colonel nodded. We were led to a large room with rows of folding chairs populated by only one man. He knelt before a coffin at the front of the chapel. The coffin was closed. Closed. Never going to see her again. Can't kiss her forehead. Can't see her one last time. But I needed to. I needed to see her. And much too loud, I asked, "Why is it closed?" And the man whose pot belly pushed out from his too tight suit turned around and walked toward me. "Her mother," he said. "Her mother had an open casket, and Alaska told me, 'Don't ever let them see me dead, Daddy.' And so that's that. Anyway, son, she's not in there. She's with the Lord." And he put his hands on my shoulders, this man who had grown fat since he'd last had to wear a suit, and I couldn't believe what I had done to him, his eyes glittering green like Alaska's, but sunk deep into dark sockets, like a green-eyed, still-breathing ghost. "And don't, no, don't die, Alaska. Don't die." And I walked out of his embrace and passed Lara and Takumi to her casket and knelt before it and placed my hands on the finished wood, the dark mahogany, the color of her hair. I felt the colonel's small hands on my shoulders and a tear dripped onto my head. And for a few moments, it was just the three of us. The buses of students hadn't arrived and Takumi and Lara had faded away. And it was just the three of us. Three bodies and two people. The three who knew what had happened, and too many layers between all of us, too much keeping us from one another. The colonel said, "I just want to save her so bad." And I said, "Chip, she's gone." And he said, "I thought I'd feel her looking down on us, but you're right. She's just gone." And I said, "Oh God, Alaska, I love you. I love you." And the colonel whispered, "I'm so sorry, Pudge. I know you did." And I said, "No, not past tense. She wasn't even a person anymore, just flesh rotting. But I loved her, present tense." The colonel knelt down beside me and put his lips to the coffin and whispered, "I am sorry, Alaska. You deserve a better friend." Is it so hard to die, Mr. Lewis? Is that labyrinth really worse than this one?
This is the end of disc number 4. Please continue listening on disc number 5.